Page 244. Fuchs writes, in the time of imperialism, he presents the political energies of art polemically to an age in whose works these energies diminish from day to day. But Fuchs's standards are still those of Gervinius. In fact, they can be traced back even further into the 18th century. This becomes possible with references to Gervinius himself, whose memorial speech for F. C. Schlosser lent a grandiose voice to the armed moralism of the bourgeoisie in its revolutionary epoch. Schlosser had been criticized for a miserable moral austerity. Gervinius, however, defended him by saying that Schlosser could and would have answered this criticism as follows. Contrary to one's experience with novels and novellas, one does not learn a superficial enjoyment of life by looking at life on a larger scale, as history, despite all the serenity of the senses and the spirit. Through the contemplation of history, one does not absorb a misanthropic scorn, but a severe outlook on the world and serious principles of life. The greatest judges of the world and of humanity knew how to measure external life according to their own internal life. Thus, for Shakespeare, Dante, and Machiavelli, the essence of the world made an impression which always led them to seriousness and severity. Footnote 40, text. Here lies the origin of Fuchs's moralism. It is a German Jacobinism whose monument is Schlosser's world history, which Fuchs came to know in his youth. Footnote 41, text. Not surprisingly, this bourgeois moralism contains elements which collide with Fuchs's materialism. If Fuchs had recognized this, he might have been able to ameliorate this conflict. He was convinced, however, that his moralistic consideration of history and his historical materialism were completely harmonious. This was illusory. Underlying this illusion is a widespread opinion badly in need of revision that the bourgeois revolutions, as they are celebrated by the bourgeoisie, are the genealogical root of a proletarian revolution. Footnote 42, text. On the contrary, it is necessary to look at the spiritualism which is woven into these revolutions. The golden thread of this spiritualism were spun by morality. Bourgeois morals function under the banner of inwardness. The first signs of this were already exhibited in the Reign of Terror. The keystone of this morality is conscience. Whether the conscience of Robespierre's Citoyen or that of the Kantian cosmopolitan, the attitude of the bourgeoisie proclaimed the moral authority of conscience, which proved favorable to bourgeois interests but depended on a complementary attitude of the proletariat, unfavorable to the interests of the latter. Conscience carries the banner of altruism. Conscience advises the proprietor to act according to concepts which are immediately fruitful to his co-proprietors. And conscience easily advises the same for those who possess nothing. Page 245. When the latter takes this advice, the advantage of their behavior for the proprietor becomes the all more immediately obvious as this advice becomes more doubtful for those who follow it, as well as for their class. For this reason, the price of virtue rests in this attitude. Thus, a class morality becomes dominant. But the process occurs on an unconscious level. The bourgeoisie did not need consciousness to establish this class morality as much as the proletariat needs consciousness in order to overthrow that morality. Fuchs does not do justice to this state of affairs because he believes that his attack must be directed against the consciousness of the bourgeoisie. He sees deceit in bourgeois ideology. In view of the most shameless class judgments, he says, the fulsome babble about the subjective honesty of the judges in question proves only the lack of character of those who write or speak in this way. At best, one might ascribe it to their denseness. Footnote 43, text. Fuchs, however, does not think of judging the concept of bona fide, good conscience, itself. Yet this will occur to historical materialists not only because the historical materialists recognize that the concept is the bearer of bourgeois class morality, but also because he will not fail to see that this concept furthers the solidarity of moral disorder with economic plainlessness. Younger Marxists at least hinted at this situation. Thus, the following was said about Lamartine's politics, which made excessive use of bona fides. Bourgeois democracy is dependent on its value. A democrat is honest by trade. Thus, a democrat feels no need to examine the true state of affairs. Footnote 44, text. Consideration, which focus more on the conscious interests of individuals than the behavior which is imposed on their class, often unconsciously and as a result of its position in the production process, led to an overestimation of the conscious elements of the formation of ideology. This is evident in Fuchs's work when he declares, in all its essential elements, art is the idealized disguise of a given social situation, for it is an eternal law that every dominant political or social situation is forced to idealize itself in order ethically to justify its existence. Footnote 45, text. Here we approach the crux of the misunderstanding. It rests on the conception of exploitation conditions, false consciousness, at least on the part of the exploiter, because true consciousness would prove to be a moral burden. This sentence may have a limited validity for the present insofar as the class struggle has involved all of bourgeois life in the extreme. However, the bad conscience of the privileged, it's by no means self-evident for earlier forms of exploitation. Reification not only clouds the relations among human beings, the real subject of these relations remain clouded. Page 246. An apparatus of legal and administrative bureaucracies intervenes between the rulers of economic life and the exploited. The members of these bureaucracies no longer function as fully responsible moral subjects, and their sense of duty is nothing but the unconscious expression of this deformation. Fuchs's moralism, traces of which can be found in his historical materialism, was not shaken by psychoanalysis either. About sexuality, he makes the following statement. All forms of sensual behavior are justified in which the creative elements of this law of life becomes visible. Those forms, however, are evil in which this highest of drives becomes degraded to a mere means of refined craving of pleasure. Footnote 46, text. It is clear that this moralism carries the bourgeois signature. Fuchs never acquired the proper distrust for the bourgeois scorn for pure sexual pleasure and the more or less fantastic means of creating it. In principle, to be sure, he declares that one can speak of morality and immorality only in relative terms. Yet, in the same passage, he states immediately an exception for absolute immorality, which identifies itself by transgressions against the social drives of society and are thus, so to speak, a transgression against nature. According to Fuchs, this position is characterized by the historically inevitable victory of the masses over a degenerate individuality. For the masses are always capable of development. Footnote 47, text. In short, it is true of Fuchs that he does not attack the justification for condemning allegedly corrupt tribes, but beliefs about the history and extent of these tribes. Footnote 48, text. Because of this, the clarification of the sexual psychological problem is hampered. Thus, the rule of the bourgeoisie, this clarification has become particularly important. This is where the taboo of more or less wide areas of sexual pleasure has its place. The repressions which are thus produced in the masses bring to the fore masochistic and sadistic complexes. Those in power then further these complexes by delivering up to the masses those objects which prove most favorable for their politics. Wedekind, a contemporary of Fuchs, recognized these connections. Fuchs failed to produce a social critique in this regard. Therefore, a passage which he compensates for his lack of means of a detour through natural history becomes all the more important. The passage in question is his brilliant defense of orgies. According to Fuchs, the pleasure of orgiastic rites belongs to the most valuable tendencies of culture. One must understand that orgies belong to that which distinguishes us from animals. In contrast to humans, animals do not know orgies. Page 247. When their hunger and thirst are satisfied, animals will turn away from the juiciest feed and the clearest spring. Further, the sexual drive of animals is generally restricted to specific and brief periods of the year. This is quite different from human beings, and in particular from creative human beings. The latter do not know the concept of enough at all. Footnote 49, text. Fuchs's sexual psychological statements draw their strength from thought processes in which he deals critically with traditional norms. This enables him to disperse certain petite bourgeois illusions. That goes for nudism, in which he rightly sees a revolution of narrow-mindedness. Happily, humans being are not forest animals any longer. Thus we desire that fantasy, even erotic fantasy, play its part in clothing. What we do not want, however, is exactly that social organization of humanity which deprives all of this. Footnote 50, text. Fuchs's psychological and historical understanding becomes fruitful for the history of clothing in many ways. In fact, there is hardly a subject matter apart from fashion which more closely approaches the author's threefold interest, namely, his historical, social, and erotic interests. This already becomes evident in his definition of fashion, which, in its language, is successive of Karl Kraus. Fashion, he says, in his Sittengeschichte, History of Morals, indicates how people intend to deal with the business of public morality altogether. Footnote 51, text. Fuchs, by the way, did not succumb to the general mistake of examining fashion only according to aesthetic and erotic viewpoints, as did, for example, Max von Böhm. He did not fail to recognize the role of fashion as a means of domination. As fashion brings out the subtle distinction of social standing, it keeps a particularly close watch over the causal distinction of the class.